B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, May 17th, 2019. Your humble host has just returned from a week off, spent time with family and friends in New York City. And I'm going to catch up today on a week of many outrages. And topping my list is the freeing and then reincarceration of Chelsea Manning. It is stunning to see the brutal police state and federal courts try to pound this person into submission. And I salute the principled stand that Chelsea Manning has taken, saying that she already testified about WikiLeaks and all of that hoo-ha during her court-martial, and that this is an effort to get her to somehow incriminate Julian Assange. And her refusal drew a prison sentence, 62 days, including almost half that time in solitary confinement. And she was out for less than a week. They served her with a new subpoena before she was released to appear before a newly impaneled grand jury whose term could be as long as 18 months. And the judge is ratcheting up punitive sanctions. And I say punitive because this is critical under the language of the law. Chelsea Manning's principled refusal is something that causes a court to declare her to be in contempt. And Chelsea has already shown that she is willing to take it and not concede. And so the judge is repeating the application of this punitive sanction and ratcheting up, saying that if she doesn't testify before the grand jury within 30 days, that he will start fining her $500 a day. And after 60 days, that fine will double to $1,000 a day. And if the grand jury's term ran as long as the potential 18 months, that fine could total as much as $500,000. And I believe that friends of Chelsea Manning will rally, and I will be pleased to contribute to a fund to pay those court fines. And I believe that she will not crater under this additional punishment or the threat thereof. Once again, the court refused to hear her arguments, the motion to quash. Part of the contempt hearing was held in secret. And what is really offensive and outrageous is this guy, G. Zachary Terwilliger, the U.S. attorney, with this condescension. The only thing that's being asked of her is to come answer questions truthfully. As someone who received the incredible gift of a commutation, was literally given 28 years of her life back, she now refuses to simply answer questions as part of our constitutional criminal justice process. This is the real witch hunt in Washington. They are desperate to nail Julian Assange. And they're willing to weaponize Chelsea Manning to do so, but she declines the honor. She said, ultimately, this is an attempt to place me back in confinement. I think that the questions are the same questions I was asked at the court martial 7 or 8 years ago. They're not asking anything new. And this is another battle where most Americans take a pass, most elected officials, including the so-called resistance to Trump, they're silent. I believe during the last lockup, only Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard went public with opposition to that move. So Manning's attorney, Moira Meltzer-Cohen, said that jailing Manning after she's already shown that incarceration won't convince her to testify would transform the sanction into punishment. which is not allowed under federal law. Now, typically, fines are used against corporations who are in contempt of court because you can't lock up a corporation. And this is another, I believe, violation of fundamental rights that are guaranteed to us under the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. And the clock is ticking as well on the British side, as the Justice Department has 60 days from April 11th, when Julian Assange was arrested, to tell the authorities in Britain what the final charges will be. Once that happens, we are told that if the law is observed, prosecutors cannot add any additional indictments. And so, this is a battle of wills, and I believe that Chelsea Manning has a stronger commitment to her sense of justice than these bozos from the U.S. Attorney's Office. And one of them, an assistant U.S. attorney, Tom Traxler, told the judge that he didn't think a fine would compel Manning to testify, since she can just go on social media and launch a fundraising campaign. Another outrage that occurred during my week off was the arrest and eviction of a group of individuals who were voluntarily protecting the embassy of the nation of Venezuela in Washington, D.C. And I watched with interest as Colonel Ann Wright and others live streamed from the scene. As you know, the U.S. recognizes this illegitimate attempt to take down the legitimate Maduro government led by Juan Guaido. Guaido's rump supporters were there claiming that they have legitimate access to the embassy in Washington. And I want to applaud Medea Benjamin of Code Pink, Kevin Zeese, and Margaret Flowers. They are longtime, again, principled protesters. And on Thursday morning, the cops finally came, and it's interesting because they did not claim that they were trespassing. They said there's some obscure charge that they were guilty, or they're accused of interference with police orders or police activities. And I believe that's because the Vienna Conventions clearly give the current government of Venezuela the right to determine who occupies their embassy. And since the U.S. vacated the embassy in Caracas, I believe that the Maduro government recalled their officials and left it kind of vacant. So we'll see what kind of charges Zeese and Flowers, and there were two other individuals whose names I don't have, who were arrested in the final stage of that protective occupation. And there's more outrage as red states are busy passing laws that they know are unconstitutional, aimed at pandering to the anti-abortion crowd, and trying to tee up more and more cases for the U.S. Supreme Court. They see as the promising signal that Justice I Like Beer Brett Kavanaugh, the sometime Catholic, who is opposed to abortion rights, they see the opportunity here to set up a case that the court will take as soon as next year to either chip away at abortion rights, hand it back to the states where Alabama, Missouri, and the others who have passed these six-week or fetal heartbeat bills, we know that they are flatly unconstitutional. And I've seen wide circulation of the picture of the 25 white males in the state senate in Alabama who pushed this abortion, it is an effective de facto abortion ban, into law. And Kay Ivey, the governor of Alabama, she is going to sign it, as is, we're told, the governor of Missouri. So we have four states, Alabama, Georgia, Kentucky, Mississippi, make it five now with Missouri, who have passed these flatly unconstitutional bills. Alabama's is most extreme. Then we have Arkansas and Utah that ban abortion after 18 weeks. They're testing the second trimester limit, the 26-week limit, that was implicit in Roe versus Wade. And so we now have a mere 17 states that are operating under standards consistent with Roe versus Wade. Or at least that's the status of legislation. Let me be clear about that. This is a huge setback for a woman's right to choose, something that was once a center plank of the platform of the Democratic Party. And a few female candidates, particularly running for president, have spoken up. They object. But the national leadership of the Democratic Party is largely silent now on issues of abortion rights. They're reading the polls, and they're making a gross political trade-off here. Their rationalization is, well, we can do more to protect a woman's right to choose by electing Democrats who hold a majority, even if many of those Democrats are anti-choice. Pelosi came out this week saying Democrats shouldn't eliminate so-called pro-life politicians from running for Congress as a Democrat. I never thought I would see this. It is shocking. Not that the right is ascendant in trying to, in a patriarchal manner, deny women this fundamental right and fundamental choice. But the Democrats are running away from it. And that's, of course, not the only issue that they run away from. We're seeing some Democrats start to stand up opposing the run-up to war with Iran. Now, we're seeing some bluff tactics deployed here by Trump and his team. Trump playing the good cop to John Bolton and Mike Pompeo's bad cop over Iran. But when Trump told a group yesterday, or maybe it was Wednesday, that he doesn't want war with Iran, that's bullshit. He's willing to attack Iran. He's hoping that the bluff games will get them to somehow come to a table and agree to a deal that is, you know, simply ridiculous on the face of it. It would involve not just an extension of Obama's nuclear deal, but also other restrictions on their ability to have missiles, and it's something that Iran will flatly never agree to. So we are seeing some movement. Tulsi Gabbard, in my view, has been the clearest Democratic presidential candidate opposing regime change wars and has been strong in her opposition to any military action against Iran. She was joined this week by Bernie Sanders, who I think gave a pretty good speech and who has taken a strong enough position for me on Iran. I wish he had the same insight and a similarly strong position opposing the U.S. intervention in Venezuela right now. And we're seeing Senators Gillibrand of New York, Warren of Massachusetts, and Klobuchar of Minnesota, all running for president, become co-sponsors of a bill that would deny budget funding to any military action against Iran. So far, no movement from Cory Booker, Michael Bennett of Colorado, and Kamala Harris, the other senators who are presidential candidates. And we're also seeing on the House side, I'm a little surprised pleasantly by this, but Silicon Valley Congresswoman Anna Eshoo has become one of a few co-sponsors of a bill in the House to achieve the same thing. And it has not been signed by Gabbard, by Seth Moulton of Massachusetts, Tim Ryan of Ohio, or Eric Swalwell, other House members who are Democrats who've announced they're running for president. I want to recommend a piece. I've thrown up a link to this story in the show file for today's podcast under the byline of Mehdi Hasan at The Intercept. And he points out, based on the ugly experience of the way the media became stenographers and allowed themselves to be used by Bush and Cheney and Colin Powell, to propagandize the American public and pave the way for the invasion of Iraq in 2002 and the invasion itself in 2003. And Hassan cites four simple steps the media can take to prevent a replay of that debacle. And while he's focused only on Iran, if you read the article, I encourage you to think that the same should apply to Venezuela. So Hassan begins by recapping recent headlines from corporate media outlets, CNN, U.S. deploying more Patriot missiles to Middle East amid Iranian threats, New York Times, Pentagon builds deterrent force against possible Iranian attack, Wall Street Journal, U.S. says Iran likely behind ship attacks, Wash Post, Iranian threats led to White House deployment announcement, officials say. Now, we know from the comments of British leaders that John Bolton's claim that there's new intelligence that is disturbing that led us to send the Abraham Lincoln carrier fleet toward the Persian Gulf, it is highly exaggerated. They apparently found some missiles that were installed on a couple of fishing boats in the Persian Gulf. And I can't explain what that means, but is that a threat to the United States that requires this kind of saber rattling? So Hassan says, look, here are four suggestions for the media. Stop the stenography. Simply passing along the claims of U.S. officials without checking whether they are true or not is not even close to the definition of journalism. And this happens a lot, where a corporate media reporter gets an exclusive leak from an anonymous source and runs with it. Here's one, Barbara Starr at CNN. Just in, U.S. officials tell me the threats from Iran included specific and credible intelligence that Iranian forces and proxies are targeting U.S. forces in Syria, Iraq, and at sea. Yeah, like missiles on a fishing boat in the Persian Gulf can threaten U.S. forces in Syria or Iraq. So, the complicity of the U.S. media cannot be understated. Hassan goes on to say, rule number two, get your facts straight. Well, that goes without saying, but it is not an emphasized element of reporting in many media outlets today. Then he demands context, and this is something that really sings to me, because there is too little context, whether it is Iran or in Venezuela. The context of the so-called illegitimate elections last May in Venezuela, never defined in the corporate media. It's just passed along as a settled fact. And his final tip is get better sources. Why can't we hear from skeptical and anti-war voices too? And I've raised this issue about the Public Television News Hour. I haven't seen a single guest on that show voicing opposition to regime change in Venezuela or going beyond just kind of milquetoast objection to Trump's bluster toward Iran. Caitlin Johnstone is on top of it again, using a leaked document from the organization for the, what is that called? OPCW. It's the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons. I think it means prevention. Anyway, a document that's been leaked from there shows that the attack last April in Douma, Syria, that was widely reported to have been a chemical attack staged by the Assad government. Well, there was a dissenting report over there at OPCW, and it was suppressed. And now it has surfaced, and you can't blame this one on Julian Assange or WikiLeaks. And Johnstone quotes George Galloway, a British MP, "The war machine has now been caught red-handed in a staged chemical weapons attack, for the purposes of deceiving our democracies into what could have turned into a full-scale war amongst the great powers." And what we learn is that the so-called attack was staged, that the gas canisters that were said to contain nerve agents could not have been delivered by an aircraft. And that means that rebels on the ground, desperate to widen the war and get attention from the U.S. and other countries, staged this scene in Douma. And as you know, I've been skeptical of it since the very first reports. And likewise, other cases that were cited during the long-running Syrian conflict and laid at the feet of the Assad government have proven dubious at best. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. And while I was away, PayPal collected $5 from Polina Vasilev, $5 from Andrew Harnack, $10 from Susan Lundgren, and my great volunteer producer of my local TV show, In Conversation, Virginia Suders Mason, just renewed her annual subscription. Virginia, I am very, very grateful. So you can join their ranks. It's easy to go to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu tab, and then you click on Become a Subscriber. When you land on the sign-up page, it's easy to use PayPal, and you can sign up for $5, $10, $20 a month. The $50 annual subscription earns you a bonus book, and I've got a few more copies of the important book 2100, A Dystopian Utopia. I got to visit with the architect who wrote it, Vanessa Keith, while I was in New York. And I'd love to pass a copy along to you. All you have to do is take up a new annual subscription and provide me a mailing address in the continental U.S., and I'll get the book out to you. And if you don't like PayPal, you can use the U.S. mail to communicate and to donate. Just mail it to Box 150, 660, San Rafael, California, zip code 94915. Well, in my own backyard, outrageous behavior by the San Francisco Police Department a week ago today. First, a little background. San Francisco's public defender, a respected man named Jeff Adachi, died suddenly of a heart attack, and then the autopsy showed he had cocaine and alcohol in his system. And the scene was a little compounded by the fact that he had been spending the day with a woman who was not his wife. And Jeff Adachi had a lot of enemies in the San Francisco Police Department. So the sordid details of his death were leaked to the media. And now the police department is cracking down not on the cops who leaked it, but on a freelance reporter who received, he wasn't the exclusive recipient, but he received a copy of the police report. That freelance reporter is named Brian Carmody. And about 2 weeks ago, the cops came and talked to him, and he refused to cooperate. And so last Friday, a group of police showed up with sledgehammers and pounded their way into his house. They handcuffed Carmody as they collected the computers and hard drives and flash drives, some 50 or a total of 68 items it is here. And now his attorney is blasting back, saying that San Francisco police illegally seized those computers and other property during a violent and breathtakingly overbroad search of his home and office. And again, they're going after the wrong guy. Someone within their own ranks leaked this document. If there is a violation of law, that's where it has occurred. And here in liberal San Francisco, I am sorry to say that only one or two elected officials have spoken up for the right of this journalist. The mayor, who is, by our standards, a fairly conservative person, London Breed, she defends the police. They went through an appropriate legal process to request a search warrant approved by two judges. Well, I'm sorry. We have a shield law here in California, and the San Francisco police violated that. And because the crackdown was on the presumed leaker of the dirty details of Jeff Adachi's final day on Earth, even the public defender's office initially defended the police. They've now issued a statement that they don't condone or support excessive police actions ever. But I'm ashamed. And the San Francisco Chronicle, which is championing the First Amendment and journalist rights of Mr. Carmody, is ready to sell Julian Assange down the river. And while they see big distinctions because they don't like Julian Assange, the principles are the same. These are people who received information and published it. End of story. Doesn't matter whether you like Brian Carmody or Julian Assange or believe that they had political or other motives. The principle is the same. The other disturbing element here, I picked up my San Francisco Chronicle this morning, and two headlines in conflict. The recent census of the homeless population, which plagues San Francisco, shows a 17% increase in the last 2 years. We now have 8,011 people living on the streets here, and our streets are littered with needles and poop, and there are not enough public bathrooms. It's a real scourge. And in one of the nearby counties, Silicon Valley reported a 43% increase in their homeless population. And Oakland, somewhere in between San Francisco and the South Bay. So this is a very serious issue. We spend hundreds of millions of dollars on homeless issues. And on the same front page, bill to build housing in California put on hold. And yes, this is controversial. A state senator from San Francisco, Scott Wiener, has been trying to ease some of the red tape to promote the construction of housing, especially affordable housing, all across California. And once again, his efforts have been stymied by the NIMBYs. And I don't have a perfect silver bullet solution. I recognize the communities want to control development. But for God's sake, we have become so used to people living in squalor on the streets around us. We've developed that special vision where we can just look through them and pass them and around them and not deal with the underlying issues. It's outrageous. I was surprised by the move by federal judge Emmett Sullivan, who's been presiding over the Mike Flynn trial. He ordered the government to release and publish transcripts of the conversations that Flynn had with the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, at the end of 2016. Not only that, the transcripts have to be published by May 31st, including a transcript of a threatening phone call from one of Trump's lawyers, John Dowd, to Flynn's lawyer, trying to keep the former general, Mike, in line and prevent him or induce him not to do a plea deal with Mueller. Now, that's extremely damaging. It shows a strong case of obstruction of justice. And so I salute Judge Sullivan's move here. I think it's going to be interesting to see what the implications of it are. But what I find fascinating is in today's Washington Post report on this, they completely excised the elements of that phone call between Flynn and Kislyak. There were two points of discussion. Will the U.S. boycott the U.N. vote, as it had in the past, critical of Israeli settlements in the West Bank? As you recall, in a change of heart at the end of his term, Obama went neutral for the first time in a U.N. vote on that issue. But the Washington Post doesn't think that's important enough to report. Instead, they focus on the part of the conversation where they purportedly discussed the U.S. sanctions that Obama had imposed over the alleged 2016 election meddling. And that, of course, is the heart of the Mueller report. And House Democrats who have been blocked by Trump's spin and by his stonewalling, preventing anybody from testifying. So far, they don't have a date with Bob Mueller. They haven't been able to get key witnesses to testify. And so they've been reduced to reading the Mueller report to a C-SPAN camera. Yes, the House Rules Committee has been in a continuous session for the last 24 hours or so as their members take turns reading the Mueller report. Now, I don't object to this, but this is such an empty effort. And the Democrats, while they are stewing over whether they should impeach Trump, are facing a real loss here. The clock is running, and their refusal, their rejection of impeachment, I think is a very costly mistake. And Jonathan Turley, the George Washington University law professor, was up on Capitol Hill yesterday. And he said, look, this body has decided to proceed as an oversight matter, not an impeachment matter. That will weigh heavily in any fight with the White House. The courts have indicated that on impeachment matters, there is a heavy deference that is given to this body that as a conventional oversight matter becomes more mixed. And as you know, I've been arguing until I'm blue in the face that impeachment is the constitutional remedy to Trump's lawlessness and his defiance of the power of the courts and the Congress. And Tom Steyer, the San Francisco billionaire who spent over $50 million on TV ads promoting the idea of impeachment, has a new one out, and I thank John Zwiebel for sending me the link to this. Check it out. He uses the voices of average Americans to advance the frustration because nothing has happened.
This is a message
for leaders of the Democratic Party.
For over 2 years, this president has broken the law.
And nothing happened.
You told us to wait for the Mueller investigation.
And when he showed obstruction of justice,
nothing happened.
When this president
took money from foreign governments
and blocked the release of his tax returns,
nothing happened.
And when his administration illegally refused to testify,
nothing happened.
Now you tell us to wait for the next election?
Really?
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 This is why we volunteered,
raised money,
went door to door,
and voted in the last election.
Our founding fathers expected you,
Congress,
to hold a lawless president accountable.
And you're doing nothing.
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 He broke his oath of office.
He's defying you.
He's laughing at you.
And he's getting away with it.
This is our democracy.
But Congress is part of the system, and the system is broken. We have to fix it.
Need to impeach is responsible for the content of this advertising.
There's a link if you'd like to share that commercial. It's in the show file for today's podcast. And let me acknowledge I'm roughly past my time limit today, but I'm in catch-up mode, so let me press on with a few more stories for your consideration. One is that the House passed sweeping legislation today to ban discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. The vote was 236 to 173. 8 Republicans joined the Democrats. I think this is fabulous. It's also futile. Because until there is a change in the Senate, until there is a change in the White House, all these efforts by the House to keep busy and to set an agenda mean absolutely nothing. And that's why I support impeachment. They claim, oh, it'll distract us from our mission. I'm sorry. Trump will distract you from your mission every day. I'm very pleased at the latest attempt to smear a Democratic Arabic lawmaker, Rashida Tlaib, from Detroit, for alleged anti-Semitic remarks. Now, you've probably already heard that in a lengthy discussion, she basically equated the plight of the Jews after the Holocaust with the plight of Palestinians who were displaced when Israel was created in 1948. And while you can say that her remarks were a little fuzzy or whatever, I'd like you to read this commentary by Joshua Leifer, published at The Guardian, where he describes how just malicious and unfounded the smears that were led by Liz Cheney and echoed by Donnie Trump on his Twitter box. But this time it was different, because Pelosi and her number two, Steny Hoyer, came to the defense of Rashida Tlaib. Pelosi, Republicans' desperate attempts to smear Rashida and misrepresent her comments are outrageous. Trump and the House GOP should apologize to her and the American people for their gross misrepresentations. And even Steny Hoyer, who is a loyal AIPAC guy, he stepped up and said they must stop and they owe her an apology. And Mr. Leifer notes that this is a good first step, but we need to see Democratic leaders demonstrate bravery and steadfastness that, for the most part, they have hitherto failed to show. And he closes with this: the Republicans' consistent use of outrageous false accusations of anti-Semitism, especially against prominent women of color like Representatives Omar and Tlaib, is a central part of that strategy. Fighting back against this as hard as possible is not only what Democrats must do if they want to defeat Trump and the surging white nationalist movement It is the right thing to do. While I was visiting the Big Apple this week, its mayor, Bill de Blasio, declared himself as the 23rd or 24th Democratic candidate for president. And I think de Blasio is an interesting guy. He has, he has skirted the line of some sorts of campaign fraud or access fraud while he has been mayor. But my big complaint about him is that he announced his campaign is basically based on appealing to the working class. And as I toured New York, I was just time after time reminded that this is the center of the 1%. And yesterday, before we left, we visited this new development called Hudson Yards, gleaming skyscrapers and a retail mall with Rolex and Cartier and every high-end retailer in the world. Now, this Hudson Yards project received subsidies, corporate welfare, well in excess of what was promised to Amazon before Amazon pulled out of the Long Island City deal that had been proposed for its second HQ. And as I walked through the Hudson Yards project, there was nothing there for the average taxpayer of New York whose taxes are subsidizing this center for the wealthy. And it just really served up in gross high relief for me that we have a lot of Democratic politicians who posture as concerned about working families, but they got to where they are by greasing the interests of the wealthy oligarchs in this country. Thanks for listening. My latest news and comment podcast, please share it far and wide. You'll find it on YouTube, and I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.